Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. The 60-year-old Governor Malcolm Wilson Tappan Zee Bridge north of New York City is being replaced with a new bridge. To accelerate the progress of the new New York Bridge, fast-tracked environmental permitting, procurement, and labor agreements were combined with design-build contracting to advance an idea discussed for more than a decade to a new bridge scheduled to open in 2018. Talking with us today about this new bridge is design compliance engineer and delivery manager for the New York State Thruway Authority, David Capobianco. David, I'm very happy to talk to you about this bridge today.
Well, thanks for having me, Joe. I appreciate it.
So, first of all, remind us where this bridge is located for those of us that are far outside the New York area.
Sure. It's about 20 miles north of New York City, and it spans the Hudson River between Westchester County on the east side in the village of Tarrytown and Rockland County in the village of South Nyack on the west side.
So what I remember from many, many decades ago was that this was a bridge that was kind of in the countryside, but my sense is it's now part of the New York commuter shed. Is that so?
Yeah, certainly when the bridge was built as part of the original thruway system back in the 1950s, the landscape was very different. It was very rural in nature, and certainly the construction of the bridge was one of the elements that kind of changed the dynamic, if you will, of the region, and it is now a major suburban area. Westchester County in general is, and certainly now with increased mobility because of the bridge, Rockland County and other counties to the north have better access to jobs in New York City as well as the other suburbs.
So why do you need a new bridge?
Well, you know, when it was built in the 50s, it was said, and I don't know if it's legend or not, but it was said that it was built for 50 years. And that turned out to be a pretty good estimation because it was in the late 90s and early 2000s when the Thruway Authority needed to expend increasingly more amount of maintenance funds to keep the bridge operational. As a matter of fact, in a 10-year period, we spent about $500 million, largely in replacing the deck system on the existing bridge. We were getting punch-throughs, which were basically holes in the deck on an increasing basis for many years, and they never, of course, come at a good time. They impacted peak hours of traffic, and with 140,000 vehicles a day traversing the bridge, that caused significant delays. So we had to do something, and that something got us to a bridge replacement project. Initially, it was part of a 30-mile multimodal corridor project, which stretched all the way from the Jersey state line to the Connecticut state line along the I-287 corridor. And that was studied for about a 10-year period and unfortunately never really went anywhere due to a number of factors. It was very complex with many different alternatives for the different modes of travel, many different alternatives for the bridge crossing itself, including tunnel options. And with a price tag of up to $16 billion, there was never really funding identified to meet that project cost. So it wasn't until 2011 when, under the governor's leadership, the project shifted from the corridor project to a standalone bridge replacement project. And that's what got this project really off the ground.
So what's the design of the new bridge? If I remember correctly, the old bridge is cantilever truss?
Correct. The main span is a cantilever truss, and it's over 3 miles long. So the main span being about 1,200 feet is somewhat of a insignificant portion of the entire crossing length, but the main span is a suspended cantilever truss, and the approach spans are a mix of deck trusses and multi-girder simple spans. The new bridge, which is a design-build project, so we just set out parameters for the design and construction of the project. We didn't prescribe what type of bridge needed to be built, so the best value proposer, if you will, and what we're building right now is a cable stay bridge for the main span, which is also 1,200 feet long. And then the approach spans are also multi-girder, but continuous spans and much longer spans than what we have currently on the existing bridge. We have 198 spans on the existing bridge. The new bridge will have 44. So a significant change in that regard.
So that cable section supports segmental concrete components?
Well, it's a steel superstructure. One of the proposers had a concrete segmental box superstructure. but the one we're building now will be a steel superstructure. We'll have precast deck panels that will make up the structural deck, and then a wearing surface on top of that.
Now, do I understand correctly that what we're really building is two independent bridges?
Yes, correct. The current bridge is 87 feet wide and carries 7 lanes of traffic. Initially, it was 6 lanes, but due to the increasing volumes of traffic, we squeezed another lane in there, and we have a central movable barrier that's shifted twice a day to accommodate 4 lanes in the peak direction of traffic. So when we went to build the new bridge to accommodate 4 lanes of traffic in each direction and also to accommodate shoulders so that we would be able to provide space for incident management and also the shared use path, which we wanted to have for non-motorized vehicles. It was just too wide for one single bridge. So now we have, yeah, 2 independent spans, one for eastbound and one for westbound.
Will the new bridge accommodate bicycles, pedestrians, transit?
Yes, the westbound bridge, which is the northernmost span, will have a 12-foot wide shared use path for bicycles and pedestrians. And that's something that we, as well as the communities on either side of the bridge, are very excited about since there's no non-motorized access across the existing bridge. And as far as transit, yeah, one of the key elements in kind of pivoting, if you will, from the corridor study, which had a transit element to it, and into a standalone bridge project, was how do we build in a transit component but still kind of respect the NEPA process and not having to be concerned about segmentation as far as the environmental impact statement is concerned. So in working with the Federal Highway, we came up with the concept of maximizing the public investment. And what we felt was reasonable was for the foundations to be designed and constructed to accommodate the heaviest transit loading, which was a commuter rail, or is a commuter rail, E60 loading. So the foundations will be able to accommodate commuter rail, and the notion is that the rest of the bridge needs to be designed so that it could, with modifications, accept transit loading. And we had Metro North Railroad on our team to provide peer review. We had the design builder. They had to illustrate to us conceptually how a transit could be added in the future. So we have that in our back pocket should transit become feasible in the future.
Okay.
And if it becomes feasible in the future, we won't have to go back into the river again, which that was the primary objective of designing the foundations to accommodate that load. Okay. So you wouldn't have to disturb that most important resource.
So you have the flexibility built into the design.
Correct.
So tell us a little bit more about the fast-tracking aspect of this project, which I know a lot of people have been talking about.
Sure. Well, it was October of 2011 when the governor announced that we would be suspending the corridor project and advancing a standalone bridge project. And it was in that same month that President Obama designated the project for priority review. And it was one of 6 transportation projects that were identified in that way. And what that enabled us to do was to fast-track the environmental review process and produce an environmental impact statement and get to a record of decision in 11-month time frame, which is unprecedented. So the priority designation, basically anytime we had a permit or any other submission to any of the regulatory agencies, it went right to the top of their inbox. And we had actually a White House dashboard that they were held accountable to as far as the schedule, and it really enabled us to fast track the process. So that, in addition to having the corridor study, you know, we had 10 years of study for the corridor project. That also helped immensely as we could reuse some of the information that we had learned from the corridor study as well.
So the way you describe fast-tracking, it sounds like you didn't shortcut the process. You just moved up the priority list.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a great point, and I'm glad you mentioned that. We really didn't take any shortcuts whatsoever. As a matter of fact, I think in a lot of ways, we went above and beyond what we felt were the minimum requirements from an environmental perspective. That was one of the keys, too, to getting through the process in a faster process. Was going above and beyond. We have about 70 what we call environmental performance commitments that, again, were not part of the permits per se, but were extra things that we said that we would do that would meet the needs of the regulatory agencies and also address some of the community concerns as well. the project wasn't looked on favorably by some people when it was part of the corridor study. We needed to kind of change the way the public viewed the project, and part of that was identifying means that we would include in the contract to address some of the concerns that the community was having.
Can you give us one example of how you would address the specific concern?
Sure. You know, one of the things that we heard frequently in the public hearings from the public was, you know, the noise and air pollution, vibration and dust control, et cetera. So what we did was we built into the request for proposals for the design build contract the requirement to have environmental monitoring devices on each landing or each shore. So right now, if you go to our website, we have 10 monitoring devices that the public can review, and it shows how noisy construction is, the limits of air pollution. We have very stringent requirements relative to air pollution. They're on par really with what was done in the area of the World Trade Center after 9/11 as far as the reconstruction effort. We have stringent controls as far as exhaust requirements for construction equipment, and then as well, like I said, the public can go to our website and check that. Part of those monitors also measure vibration levels. So that's another way that we're trying to be very transparent to the public and addressing their concerns.
So it sounds to me, as you describe it, it's monitoring, but not just monitoring. It's monitoring to assure compliance with an established standard on the externalities produced during the construction process.
Yes, you're absolutely right. We do have thresholds for noise and air, and that's just it. There are certain occasions where the contractor has submitted waivers for various reasons for certain activities, which we have granted. We do have unique measures to reduce noise by having temporary noise barriers put in place for what are seen as very noisy activities that are close to residences. So you're absolutely right. We do have a compliance part of that monitoring.
So it's clear from what you just described that fast tracking saved you time. Did it have any effect on cost?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the other part of that fast tracking that we really should mention is that while we were going through the environmental process at lightning speed, we were also going through the procurement process for design build. And this was New York State's first design build contract. As a matter of fact, we actually went forward with the request for qualifications a month ahead of when we had enabling legislation. We were the 42nd state, I believe, to have design build as a contracting method. So as far as fast tracking, not only the procurement, but also the construction, design build was felt to be the method that would get us there as well. So as part of the review of the proposals, it was clear that we were under the duration as far as construction, and also under cost as compared to what we had estimated as part of the EIS. So it saved us time and it saved us money as well.
So design build, as I understand it, means you have a single team with which you contract to do the design and the construction. And presumably that brings advantages in terms of communication between the design process and construction process.
Absolutely. You know, the design build team, in submitting their proposals, we gave them about 5 months to submit their proposal. And each team spent between $5 and $7 million, the designer with the contractor, spending long days and nights in hotels trying to come up with efficient ways that they could deliver the project that built in innovation and creativity to reduce overall construction duration and cost. So what it does is, you know, the designer knows what type of equipment the contractor is going to bring to the site, and they can design the project accordingly. In this particular case, the contractors had very large marine equipment, as well as one of the largest cranes in the world, and what is known as a left coast lifter, which was used to build the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge and was subsequently delivered to our project. And the design team approached the project knowing that they had that equipment at their disposal, and it changed the way that they designed the project.
So I just want to take you back to the fact that you're building two bridges. So did that drive the cost up?
It probably did. It's hard to say. You know, I guess you could say it would, but, you know, I think our requirements kind of, you know, led in that direction. So I don't know if there was another possibility. It also enabled the flexibility for transit in the future. Between the bridges is where the transit component would go in the future. So if it did add cost, we felt that it was worthwhile to do that, and it was seen as something that was necessary to get the project off the ground.
What's the overall cost estimate right now?
Well, everything, including our cost for administration, we're just under $4 billion, $3.98 billion.
So not a bad price for a big bridge in 2016.
Not at all. And considering that in the EIS, we were looking in the mid-5. So we feel we're getting very good value.
And when will this bridge be available for us to use?
Well, we're looking at opening the first bridge. And that's another thing with the two bridges, is that we're able to build one bridge entirely offline, if you will. So we don't disturb traffic on the existing bridge. And then in early 2017, we're hoping that that bridge would be ready to receive traffic. We move all the traffic onto that one bridge and then finish up the ends of the other southern bridge, which is in conflict with the existing bridge. So we have to do some demolition there. And everything should be all done in 2018.
And the old bridge comes down.
And then the old bridge comes down, yes. We did have some people in some of the public comments request that maybe we use the bridge as a pedestrian facility, similar to Walkway Over the Hudson, which is just upriver from the Tappan Zee. But, as I mentioned, we do have to take down the ends of the existing bridge at a minimum because it is in conflict with one of the new bridges. And then it just got to an issue relative to maintenance of now a 60-year-old bridge, which kind of drove this whole project in the first place. So, yes, the entire existing bridge comes down.
Okay. Well, I think we can all look forward to first 2017 and then maybe 2018 to use both directions of this new bridge.
Absolutely, as well as the shared use path.
Sounds very good. Well, thank you so much for describing this interesting project to us, David, and I hope I'll see you on that bridge someday.
All right, very good. Nice talking to you, Joe. Thank you.